You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, episode 14, Cybok's Magic Stare. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including StarTrek.com's most underrated series and most underrated TOS movie polls, J.J. Abrams on the future of Trek on TV, the Kennedy Space Center's Sci-Fi Summer, and Patrick Stewart's panel from Chicago Comic-Con. And then in the feature, we'll be talking about every fan's favorite Star Trek movie, Star Trek V: The Final Frontier. But please, don't turn off the podcast. So, let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg.
Hello, Chris.
This HD technology is just getting really amazing because you look more lifelike than ever this week.
Are you using two cameras? You look very 3D.
You do too.
It's weird. So,
actually, everyone, this quite a special week for us here. Greg is actually here in the Trek FM studios with me today.
It's nice. I took a nap in the alcove, and then I've been playing with your action figures all afternoon.
The alcove is a great place to regenerate, no doubt. Oh, well, it's great to have you here for our in-person show this week.
I'm enjoying it. Not so much looking forward to my non-transport, my flight tomorrow, but
yeah.
I'm glad to be down here in Tokyo today.
Yeah, it's great. So tomorrow is the big day, the big move.
Yes.
For you. And then when we record our next show, you will be coming to us from Seattle, Washington.
That's right. I'm going to be a lot closer to many of you that are listening to us right now. I know a few people on Twitter are already in Seattle and many people up and down the West Coast. I'm hoping to get some get-togethers, but mainly just to be awake when everyone else is so I can be tweeting with you.
That's right.
And join in.
We have a lot of night owls who
that's true.
Talk to us on Twitter, but definitely everyone on Twitter who listens to the show, talks to us. So many people there in California, Washington, Oregon. All around, it's going to be a great chance to connect. So,
yeah, definitely.
Well, why don't we jump in to some news this week
and
see what we've got here. The first thing that caught my eye the other day was StarTrek.com was running one of their frequent polls, and they were trying to find out from fans which series fans consider to be the most underrated series. And the winner was Enterprise.
Mm.
What do you think about that?
That's, well, the question is, it's, you know, underrated is sort of a ratio of, you know, people think it's bad and it's actually good. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, I would say Enterprise is the best show, and I wouldn't say it's the worst show, but it probably has the most difference between those numbers. So many people hate the show. We were talking about another maybe poll on StarTrek.com where people were just hating on Enterprise constantly. And I've seen the show. I know it's not that bad.
It's not that bad, right? Yeah, I don't really get all the Enterprise hate. I mean, I agree. It's not the best of the Star Trek series. No doubt about that. It seems like there's a lot of this, a lot of hating that goes on for Enterprise. Just, it's like fashionable to hate on Enterprise more so than it being that the show was so terrible. But is it the most underrated of all the series?
Yeah.
Do you agree with that, or is there another series? Because for me, it's not at the top of my list for most underrated.
Yeah, most underrated. I actually have to go with DS9 because so many people haven't even seen it or consider it maybe like the uninteresting dark one that they're not really interested in. But it's the one with the most complex storylines, the most interesting characters. Mm-hmm. It's the one that if you're not a Star Trek fan, I say go there first and start with DS9. But a lot of people don't. They haven't even seen it a single time. People that call themselves Trekkies have seen every episode of Voyager and just never looked at DS9.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I think in a way, the way people write off Enterprise, DS9 was kind of written off early by a lot of people as well. And it for me is the most underrated, because there is this kind of lack of love, lack of respect for Deep Space Nine, and it is the richest of all the series. Yeah. It's not to say that every episode of Deep Space Nine is better than every episode of another series. Each series has its great episodes, and each series has its bad episodes. But as an entire package, an entire series, I find that DS9 is the richest, it's the most interesting, it's the one that you can get the most wrapped up in.
Right.
And it gets written off by so many people that I think it is the most underrated.
Well, so would you also say that DS9 is your favorite series overall?
Yeah, DS9 is my favorite.
Okay. So why do you think people were able to write it off so easily? Was it because TNG and then Voyager were on the air and people saw this as like a side project, or?
I don't know. The first two seasons of Deep Space Nine don't really reflect the series very well. And I think at the time that it came on, of course, Next Generation was at such a high level of popularity. Mm-hmm. What Deep Space Nine started, I think it was January of 1993.
Yeah, I believe
that's and right. And 1994 was the year, if I remember correctly, that both The Next Generation and The X-Files were nominated for Best Drama Series in the Emmy Awards, which was an unprecedented thing for science fiction shows. So Next Generation was really at a high level of popularity. I won't say it was at its height, because I think it was at its height when it ended.
Right.
At the end of season 7, it kept growing and growing. But so it was kind of an unusual thing to have another Star Trek series on. And Deep Space Nine was very well received at its premiere. Mm-hmm. I think it set records. It was the highest rated syndicated premiere ever at the time, anyway. But I think the pilot was really great. And then you got I think we talked about this on the Ready Room before. You got a number of episodes that felt kind of like Next Generation episodes.
Right.
They weren't really what we have come to know as Deep Space Nine. And I think people it lost their attention a little bit.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Like, people forget that it takes every show a few years to sort of gain their sea legs. And so maybe people never came back to DS9. People that maybe enjoyed the pilot would also enjoy season 4, but weren't around at that point. And they had Next Gen to just keep watching. Next Gen was already fantastic by that point.
Yeah, it's true. Everyone was already invested in Next Generation, and it kept going. And as soon as it went off the air, there was already Voyager.
There
was a little bit of gap, but I think it was only just autumn of 94.
Right.
There was no Star Trek on TV, but there was all the buildup to the movie generations.
Right.
And then Voyager popped in. So Deep Space Nine is the only Star Trek series that had to share airtime with another Star Trek series for its entire run.
Yep.
And it was easy, and it was the syndicated one when Voyager was the network show after it came on. Kind of easy to brush it under the rug. Yeah. And in the later seasons, if you weren't into it, it was difficult to jump into it because it was so serialized. Mm-hmm. And I think that turned off some fans as well. But if you really get into it, it's really... it depends on what you want. I mean, if you just want to pop in for an episode here or there, Next Generation is probably the best of the newer shows. Of course, Original Series is excellent for that, and Voyager works well for that too.
Right. Well, I guess the other candidate might be the animated series, which
most underrated.
Most people don't even think it exists. So
it's the most unknown.
Exactly.
If the poll had been the most unknown series,
right? I mean, I joke around about glommers and no one has any idea what I mean.
Yeah, I know. And in the last show, I remember you actually contemplated a world without glommers.
I know. It was a dark, dark place.
So, I don't really agree here that Enterprise is the most underrated series. It depends on how you look at the question.
I do agree it's a good show.
It's a show that people
should definitely check out. And I wish it had been considered more highly when it was on the air. I think people sort of took for granted that they'd always have Star Trek on the air.
Yeah.
And that if they pounded on Enterprise and said it was horrible and refused to watch, it would get better. Maybe they thought that. And
they didn't think Star Trek would ever be canceled.
They didn't think it would be canceled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like a given that Star Trek, any Star Trek series would run for 7 years. Which is understandable because we had three that did. And, you know, I never, when Enterprise launched, I never imagined it would actually be canceled during its run. But I should have known better since we were dealing with it being on a network. But
right. Well, that's what Scott Bakula said when he went in for his audition and they loved him. Yeah, it wasn't really an audition even. And I believe it was Rick Berman just walked up and said, hey, ready for the next 7 years?
Yeah.
Like it was just a given
it
to everyone.
A given. Yeah, it was. Well, speaking of these polls, just while we're on the topic of StarTrek.com polls, the poll that followed this one about the most underrated series was the poll that asked, what was the most underrated movie starring the original series cast?
Hmm.
And what do you think about that one?
Huh. So we're talking about just Star Trek movies. Or we're talking about any movie in general.
No, we're talking about T.J. Hooker movies here. Yeah. Yeah, Star Trek movies featuring the original series cast.
I think that one's an easy one to answer, actually. Star Trek 3. Because
yeah,
everyone,
that's probably true.
I don't even know why, but everyone seems to... I mean, it's that odd and even rule. That the even ones are supposed to be great. The odd ones are supposed to be really terrible. And I guess Nemesis and 3 are sort of the odd ones out in that rule.
Yeah,
rewatching it, it's pretty phenomenal.
Star Trek III is a really great movie. It also suffers the same way in the Star Wars series that The Empire Strikes Back suffers. That it's the middle of a story.
Right.
Although it wasn't conceived to be the middle of a story originally, mm-hmm. they didn't set out to make a trilogy out of 2, 3, and 4, but it turned out that way. So now when we go back and we rewatch those, it's the middle of the story And it kind of is a movie that it doesn't exactly have a beginning and it doesn't exactly have an end because the beginning picks up from Star Trek II and the end kind of leaves you hanging. I mean, you don't know what's happening with Spock. It's just begging for a conclusion.
Right, definitely.
Which Star Trek IV is kind of fulfills but doesn't completely fulfill.
Four is so odd because it sort of starts being a continuation of Star Trek 3 and then
it just turns
goes
into
off
in
its own
else.
Direction, yeah, which we talked about before on the show.
Yeah, so I would agree. Star Trek 3, I would say, is the most underrated movie starring the original cast.
So what's the best film starring the original series cast?
Well, I still have to say it's Wrath of Khan
because
I'm very nostalgic for it. My next choice after Wrath of Khan would probably be The Undiscovered Country.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, Star Trek VI, probably the best film, best Star Trek film.
Right.
Star Trek IV is a great movie, but it's kind of not a Star Trek film.
Right.
You know, it doesn't, its framework takes it out of that Star Trek universe.
Yeah, I definitely agree with VI being the best one.
Yeah, VI is also a very, very good movie. Star Trek movies. Any more news on the Star Trek movie front?
When is the next Star Trek movie coming out? I think I asked you this when I showed up in Tokyo. where is the next Star Trek movie? Can we go see it this weekend?
Yeah, that's right. I was supposed to have already been out last week, right?
No.
boy, you know, I feel sorry for J.J. Abrams sometimes. Who did I see? Some of our friends on Twitter recently mentioned that they think that when J.J. Abrams took on the task of rebooting Star Trek and making a movie, a Star Trek movie, he didn't realize that he was going to become the lightning rod for every question related to the Star Trek universe. He's got to feel, I mean, everyone knows how big Star Trek is and what you're getting into when you become involved in it. But still, I think he has to feel a bit overwhelmed these days at just the sheer frequency, sheer number and the frequency of questions that he's asked about this project.
He's out there trying to promote the new Mission Impossible movie. He's out there trying to promote Bad Robot's TV shows that are coming out this fall. And all anyone wants to ask him is about the next Star Trek film. And I guess it's because, you know, Gene Roddenberry, Rick Berman, Bob Justman, these producers made Star Trek and kind of focused on Star Trek.
That was their exclusive. That was their exclusive more thing. But not exclusive, but primary.
Yeah, but their primary thing. So if you're talking to them, it makes sense. But that was when it was TV. You know, JJ isn't thinking about making a weekly show. He made a movie. He's probably going to make another one. But yeah. He has so much more on his plate. He didn't sign on to be the honcho of Star Trek.
The torchbearer of Star Trek, basically. Right. But, which Rick Berman was for all those years.
Which I guess maybe we need someone who is. Maybe it would be good to get somebody who is out there saying, you know, I'm the guy who's spending 24/7 thinking about Star Trek.
Are you saying you're volunteering for this job?
I am. Ask me any question you want. I will answer.
Because you remember in Star Trek magazine, every issue, they had an interview with Rick Berman.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, every issue, the front of the magazine was a Q&A with Rick Berman. Just what's happening in the Star Trek universe over the past month?
Yeah.
And Rick was always more than happy to sit down and answer these questions. And he often said either nothing's happening on that front or I can't talk about it right now. But, I cannot imagine J.J. Abrams sitting down with Star Trek magazine and answering these questions. Right. It was Star Trek Communicator, I mean.
Okay.
Star Trek Communicator used to have the interviews with Rick Berman all the time. Communicator is now gone, and we have Star Trek Magazine from Titan is the current one. So.
I guess I would nominate Bob Warkey for that role. He seems to have a hand in all the different stuff.
Yeah.
He seems to be the guy spending the most time. I mean, that or the thing about the Okudas is they're not really involved in the production, in pushing it forward. They're more involved. Once it's being made, they're brought in to help.
Yeah, the Okudas are a great resource when you want to know the nuts and bolts of Star Trek.
Right.
But if you want to know what's happening right now, maybe someone like Bob Warkey would be ideal. So, Bob, we're drafting you. You are the new face of Star Trek. Yes. Please field all these questions so JJ doesn't have to.
So I guess the first question we'd ask Bob Warkey is there going to be a new Star Trek TV series? Because they also asked J.J. Abrams this.
J.J. Abrams gets asked this all the time, apparently. And I love that his answer is, it's never come up. And then the news reports are always, J.J. is open to a Star Trek TV series.
Well, the thing is, he's a guy, he is in TV. He's not making Star Trek TV, but he's made so many shows. And he's producing so much stuff. He's got two or three shows coming this fall. The idea that he's never thought about doing Star Trek TV is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean,
I have to agree that when J.J. Abrams says that, well, it's never come up, I don't know, we haven't talked about it. I do find that a little bit hard to believe. I mean, we already know that they, at least Bob Warkey is apparently talking to CBS about an animated series. I have to think there has been at least some talk about the remote possibility of doing a live action Star Trek series. But he's not going to talk about that. He's not going to come out and give you any details. Right. So he's just going to say, we haven't really talked about it.
Right. So the lesson learned is stop asking him questions.
Stop asking him questions.
He will come to you with answers when they exist.
Yeah, I think so. About the series, I mean, do you think there is any chance? I mean, obviously, I cannot imagine any scenario where they take the cast of the J.J. movies and put them into a TV show. I don't see that happening.
That'd be much too expensive. Maybe, I don't know. I don't even know. You could take a couple of them and put them in the show. It wouldn't be possible with the whole cast. So an animated show is possible.
And they're all movie actors, and they're all young, and they're all expanding their career. Yeah. And I don't see any way that you could ever even coordinate their schedules to do a TV show. So if they did an Abramsverse live action show, it would have to be about a different ship or the Academy, or it'd have to be about something like that that doesn't involve Kirk and Spock and Uhura. And do people want to see that even?
Yeah, I don't think so. I the only thing I can see happening is an Abramsverse animated show.
Yeah.
Sort of like we've talked about this on the show before, but sort of like the Clone Wars show from Star Wars, which I'd actually really love to see because I feel like kids aren't really growing up with Star Trek now. There's not the big push for Star Trek toys. There's not a whole lot of stuff about Star Trek out there, and especially the new stuff. I feel like we just had the one movie. We need a little bit more to keep that running, to make it really accepted. So an animated show, I still don't think you get the cast in, but You get people who sound like him.
Maybe. Yeah, I don't think you could even get them all to do voices for an animated show just because of scheduling issues, maybe more than anything. If the studio wanted to throw money at them, I think the money's probably there if they really wanted to do it. But scheduling-wise, it'd be like the original. You know, the original animated series, they all recorded their voiceovers for every episode independently, wherever they happened to be, and that stuff was just stitched together. So it wasn't like they were all together in a studio somewhere doing the voiceovers. Yeah. And you can kind of tell that, too, if you watch.
You can sometimes tell when somebody's line was cut in from another episode, and the vocal quality is so different. Like part of a line and then the next part of the line.
Or even the inflection is just not, it's not a response to what was just said. Right. You can tell it was recorded independently. Yeah. So.
Well, maybe we could do Star Trek Babies, and it could be about just Kirk stealing cars and Spock punching other Vulcans after taking tests.
Yeah, and Scotty figuring out how to beam grapefruits from one school to another.
That'd be fantastic. Yeah,
that reminds me of the, they did Seinfeld Babies on Muppets Tonight.
Oh, okay.
Very short-lived attempt to reboot the Muppet Show back in 96, I think it was. Great, great sketch. So, Star Trek Babies.
Yeah.
Hear the theme song right now.
Very good. Well, if you can't get enough Star Trek from J.J. Abrams and week to week, perhaps you can go to the Kennedy Space Center until September 5th when they're having Sci-Fi Summer, which includes Star Trek The Exhibition, Star Trek Live, and the Star Trek Shuttlecraft Simulator Adventure. I'm really depressed because I was actually in Kennedy Space Center a few years ago, and all they had was, I believe it's actually the original Enterprise model from the TV show. Mm. I have a picture of myself in front of it. It's very nice. But I was looking over the exhibition website, and they have an actual bridge that I believe you can even go walk on, can't you?
I think so. It looks like it's like a replica. It's like a replica set of the original series 1701 bridge. Mm. But the cool thing is that this, what's going on there, like you said, it's until September 5th, which of course is going to be like the day our show comes out, I think. but don't fear now if you're around the country. What this actually is part of, it's Star Trek The Exhibition, which is a traveling show. It was in Louisville, Kentucky, I think, before it came down here to Florida. So you'll still have a chance to see these things, even though the Sci-Fi Summer itself is ending. It's going to be moving around. But this bridge looks really cool. Yeah. And they also have a replica Guardian of Forever set from the City on the Edge of Forever.
That looked
which really looks cool. Really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I want a photo of myself jumping through there. and the bridge set that you're talking about has a replica captain's chair of Kirk's chair that you can actually sit in. And as I understand, it's free as well, you know, to sit there and take your photo. I think they had a 1701D replica at Star Trek The Experience in Las Vegas.
Oh, wow.
And there, if I understand correctly, you actually had to pay to sit in the chair and I guess do photo moment or something. So that's pretty nice. Yeah.
Will this exhibit also be run on antimatter, like the Star Trek theme park in Jordan?
I think so, yeah. Because they're developing, you know, the next generation space shuttle that runs off antimatter.
Right.
I wonder if this is going to be picked up by any news sources here. We talk about this.
So I guess this is less of a thing just all about Star Trek, and there's also learning about the future and learning about technology.
Yeah.
So it's a traveling science, exhibition, not just trying to promote Star Trek.
It goes around to, when it was in Louisville, it was at the Louisville Science Center, and now it's at the Kennedy Space Center. So it is a way of tying together science education and Star Trek.
Right.
And there are other things going on here. The other things that they have that you mentioned, the Shuttlecraft Simulator Adventure.
Yeah, it sounds really cool.
Which they have a shuttle called the Hawking.
Mm-hmm. Good name.
Yeah, good name for science tie-in. And, of course, here you sit in, it's a mock shuttlecraft, and it takes off, and you go to engage and avoid the Borg, because you don't want to be assimilated while you're in Florida.
terrible place to be.
They
assimilated.
Saved that for the retirement home right here. It's, you know, they tend to use the Borg for these things. So, but it might be fun.
Yeah.
To do, and then Star Trek Live, which is an interactive show.
Right. So I'll definitely have to look for this, where it's going next. I grew up near a science center that had exhibits like this coming through all the time in Charlotte. So I imagine other places around the country are going to be getting it. I don't see a reason for this to end anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to end anytime soon. You can actually go, Star Trek, the exhibition itself has its own website, which we'll put a link to that in the show notes and you can find out more. And also just watch on Trek FM, and as we find out where it's going next, we will let you know on there as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So speaking of science here, science fiction or science fact, Greg, have you ever found yourself wishing that you had a tractor beam on hand?
Mostly when I'm riding my bike and a car cuts me off. I just want to shoot out a little tractor beam, pull into a stop, race past them. I would use it very maliciously. The tractor beam is an interesting idea. It's sort of like a magic lasso for spaceships.
Right. Or you can make a small tractor beam, and you could use it for, you know, pulling objects across your desk.
That's true.
Who knows? Well, sometimes on here we talk about these technologies that we see in Star Trek and whether we'll ever see these in real life. And this is a column that TrekNews.net has from time to time called Science Fiction or Science Fact. And I think last time we talked about warp drive.
Right.
We talked about this TrekNews.net column. And so tractor beams here, warp drive is something that we decided that maybe eventually.
Right.
In the distant future anyway.
A lot of discoveries have to be made first.
Yeah, we're not close to it, but maybe they'll figure out how to travel faster than light.
Right, right.
Tractor beams are one of those things that seems plausible, I think, but when you look into the science of it, it seems like it could actually be quite difficult to build.
I think the main problem you run into is the conservation of energy, and just how do you, when you're a starship and you're not anchored to anything, how do you pull something towards you or push it away? Because if you've ever seen someone in zero G and they push them away from a wall, obviously they're not pushing the spaceship away from them, so they're just pushing themselves.
Yeah.
So if you ended up shooting a tractor beam at anything, you would get the energy from that thing would push you as much as you would push it. So I don't know exactly how it would work the way it's shown on the show.
Yeah, it looks cool the way it is on the show, but maybe not practical in reality. And in this article, you know, they talk about that. Like in space, if you started pulling a ship towards you with a tractor beam and you turn off the tractor beam, I mean, the ship is going to continue to travel towards you. The ship's not just going to stop suddenly wherever you turn off the beam. So it'd actually be kind of a dangerous device to use. It reminds me in the episode, which is the episode where Q loses his powers.
Oh.
And the asteroid is going to hit the planet.
Yes. I know what you mean. It's a Voyager episode.
No, it's a Next Generation episode. And this asteroid is going to hit the planet.
Something different in Voyager.
Different in Voyager. Q loses his powers all the time. That Q. This was an asteroid was going to impact a planet, and they were trying to stop it.
Right.
And they were using a tractor beam to try to nudge the asteroid. I mean, I think scientifically that might be a little bit difficult to do here. But this is an interesting article anyway. That it really goes very in-depth into science of it and talks about the ways that we might be able to build something right now. And they talk about how imagining a tractor beam, basically, maybe you could do it by a projection of magnetic fields that attract nearby objects toward the source of the field, and using a solenoid, which is like a cylindrical coil of wire that acts like a magnet to move electrical currents to create a tractor beam.
So I guess the idea would be, if you do have two objects, you know, in space, and one of them is under power, and the other one has no power, you could theoretically use this space magnet and either push it away or pull it towards you. You'd have to anchor yourself in space using thrusters or whatever, and they'd pretty much have to not be trying to make it not happen, because if they tried to go away, there's no way you're going to be able to really latch onto them.
So the other ship's trying to go to warp, and you engage tractor beams to stop the warp. I mean, that's not going to work.
I think best case scenario, you also go to warp with them in that
situation.
That
would be an interesting sight.
It would be.
It's like when a weak person is grabbing onto a rope to try to like stop a lion or something.
Exactly,
the lion takes off running and dragging you behind it.
Right, exactly. I mean, you think of it like that. Like, sure, if I attach a lasso to you and just pull you towards me as you roll along the floor, that's fine. But if you don't want to move, there's not an awful lot I can do about it.
Right, yeah. Well, it seems anyway, without going into deep scientific detail here, that tractor beams are, I'm not going to say that they're impossible because you never know what we're going to, you know, find out.
Right.
We're able to do. I mean, there's a new story last week, I think, about scientists who have found like a universal antiviral.
Oh, wow.
Agent now that they've actually been able to cure 20 or so different viruses with this just one single treatment. So, and that's something that, you know, even a year ago, at least the average person that wasn't involved in the research would have thought impossible. So you never know what's really, truly impossible.
As Cybok would say, you know, these barriers aren't real. Like, you have to just believe that these barriers don't exist, and then they just go away magically.
Treatment for viruses. These viruses are not real.
Exactly.
So anyway, if you're interested in the concept of tractor beams, this is a really great article over on treknews.net, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes, and you can jump over and find out all about it, and it really goes into a lot of the science. So, Greg, do you remember who Dave Warner is?
I do, but if I hadn't seen this article, I'm not sure I would have, but I certainly know the roles he's played. He was first Ambassador St. John Talbot in Star Trek V, the greatest Star Trek film. He was also Klingon Chancellor Gorgon in the very next film, obviously under heavy makeup. And then he played Gol Madred in Chain of Command. I remember Chain of Command on Next Gen.
Yeah.
I don't know if I remember his character particularly, but...
Well, Gol Madred, I think, was the Gol who was interrogating all that episode.
Right.
What's interesting there, Warner said that he... I think he was pulled in to do Chain of Command on like 3 days' notice.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that there was no way he could learn the lines and the technobabble and everything. So he says that all the lines that he delivers in Chain of Command, he's like reading them off of a card over Patrick Stewart's shoulder.
Right.
But yeah, he's been in so many things. Just to name a few, Titanic, Horatio Hornblower, Time Bandits and Tron and Tales from the Crypt. I don't know, you remember that.
I've seen I just watched Planet of the Apes, and yeah, he was in that, the original.
Yeah, and Babylon 5, Doctor Who, it's just so many things. And then it's interesting to me here, the contrast between his character in Star Trek 5 and 6.
Oh, yeah.
Because very, very different characters. Star Trek V, we've got the kind of greasy-looking human ambassador, John Talbot, who has his eyes set on the Romulan ambassador.
Yeah, I was sort of joking around with you that I bet he's just going to say he showed up on set and smoked a bunch and then went home.
That's what it looks like, right?
But then it is. He basically says he had a larger role that was cut down and... He just stood on the Enterprise and didn't do much.
It is like that. It's like in the first half of Star Trek V, he's just smoking a cigarette and checking out that Romulan.
Yeah.
And then when he appears later in the movie, he's just standing around on the Enterprise the whole time and until he thinks he's going to get to do something. And then Kirk says, "You all wait here." And then they all look dejected. And that's it. So, But he says he did have a bigger role in Star Trek V, and it just kind of all got cut out. But Star Trek VI, he plays a much more important role as Gorkon.
Yeah, Gorkon was great. If you're a real Trekkie, you know that Gorkon was sort of a combination of Gorbachev and Lincoln, this idea of someone who really wants to bring peace.
Now, are you saying that they tried to transport Mikhail Gorbachev and Abraham Lincoln, and they got like a Tuvix kind of transporter malfunction, and we got Gorkon there?
That sounds like a great episode for the animated series, actually. They travel to a planet that is like a perfect replica of 1990s or 1980s Earth, and then one that's 1860s Earth.
Oh, gosh. It's the two hemispheres, right? Hemisphere is stuck in the
1980s. Perfect.
Yeah.
And then there's a transporter accident.
That's the kind of thing that animation is perfect for, right? Because you don't have to build all those sets. All you need is just draw it out.
But the character himself was a quite interesting one, and it is interesting. He says that he thinks he forgot that he was in Star Trek V.
Right. I think a lot of fans forgot that there was a Star Trek V, right?
So
maybe he wants to forget he was in Star Trek V.
Of course, they do this with many people. We talked earlier about now I'm blanking on his name, Wei Yun and all.
Well, Jeffrey Combs.
Jeff Combs, and how he just, you put him in different makeup and tell him he's a different character, and you can't really tell unless you're really paying attention.
Yeah.
It feels like a different person.
Well, it does, because, I mean, when I look at Talbot and I look at Gorkon, I don't see any similarity there. Or Madred either. Mm. So, yeah, great job there.
That Cardassian makeup is, I wouldn't want to get into that.
No. I wouldn't get into that either. Which, I wonder, Morn's makeup seemed quite something on Deep Space Nine, too.
Was that always the same actor playing Morn?
I don't know.
Just have a head? There was a StarTrek.com, I guess it was just a tweet that asked, who's the funniest character on DS9? And of course, it's Morn. Everyone knows he was the funniest character.
Which is an anagram of Norm from Cheers, right? He just sits at the bar at Quark's. Although Norm talked a lot.
That's true.
Morn doesn't say anything, but...
Not on the air, but as soon as the camera stops rolling, Morn just goes on and
shut up, would he? Just talk everyone's ears off.
Indeed.
And that's bad when you're a Ferengi, because you've got big ears.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to this interview. Mm. Anyway, it's over on StarTrek.com.
Yeah.
Interview with David Warner.
Quite interesting.
And talking about Star Trek actors, we've got one more item in the news today, and that's about Patrick Stewart.
A is for adorable. Yeah, he was at the Chicago Comic Con, the big comic convention in Chicago. This is... If anybody saw the story where he engaged...
I was going to say, most people know he was there because of the engaged thing.
Right.
But actually, he did do other things while he was there. He was not just there to engage that couple.
It's just a perfect thing that he did that. I want him at the wedding. You know, make it so he may not kiss the bride. Everything. Just as long as he doesn't turn the wedding around... or try to blow it up. But he had a long...
The self-destruct button.
Does anyone have any reason why this marriage should not take place? Blow it up! Blow it up now! Anyway, he had this panel where he was actually there with his son, David Stewart, and they just answered some questions. Obviously, he's been doing the convention circuit for years and has maybe the same story. So if you've been to a convention, you've heard much of this before. It's a great, great story he told of the first season when he was so serious and didn't think there should be any joking around on the set. And he brought all the actors in together, which I can't imagine, and just lectured them about how they needed to be serious. And
is that why Denise Crosby left the show?
I think it might be. He said she's the one who spoke up and said, Patrick, we can't have fun as well.
Yeah, we have to have fun here.
Yeah.
You have to, though. I mean, I think a lot of people watch TV shows and they think, oh, this is such a glamorous life. You know, you just get to play around me on TV show. No, but that's a really grueling schedule that TV actors go through.
Yeah.
On the set all the time. You got to have fun.
Yeah. I mean,
any job, you got to have fun.
Oh, yeah. And when you see a bloopers reel of them like clubbing a line or joking around, it's not because they're so happy they're on set that they're just making jokes left and right. It's because the day is really long and they have to entertain themselves somehow. So, yeah. So speaking of which, he said there's that video I was referencing a moment ago where he sort of dances around in a top hat on the bridge of the Enterprise. And I guess we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, let's do that.
Which he said was a private gift for Gene Roddenberry and was never supposed to be on the internet.
Right, but as we know, anything you do these days, if it's filmed, it's going to end up on the internet.
Yep. I think he learned his lesson quite well.
Yeah, he did. He said it didn't have piano originally, right?
Right.
And someone took it and added piano accompaniment in a different key than he was singing in. And so now it looks like he was singing off key because no one ever believes that the piano was in the wrong key. It has to be the singer, right?
Yeah. I think I've seen the video though without the music, so we'll have to find the canonical version and let people listen to that.
I also loved the story he told in there about how he said when they rehearsed Next Generation that they didn't use the actual lines from the show. They would just kind of ad-lib things during rehearsal. And he said every time there is danger, which is like every 15 minutes, that he would throw himself into the arms of Jonathan Frakes and yell, "We're all going to die. We're all going to die." Must have just...
I imagine
that the rest of the cast must have just been rolling on the floor. You got the captain who's so like this figure that everyone looks up to for his wisdom and his calm in the face of danger and doing this. I don't think I could have gone on with the scene if I had been part of the cast there.
Well, that's where he said he did extras with Ricky Gervais, and they eventually had to send Ricky Gervais away from the set so they could do Patrick's part because Ricky wouldn't stop laughing. Every time Patrick opened his mouth, Ricky would be laughing.
I bet. Because after something like that happens so many times with somebody, you just assume the next thing they're going to say is funny. And so they don't even have to say anything. It's like in your head.
Right. So it's a great panel. Definitely worth checking out. I'm looking forward to seeing Patrick Stewart in a convention soon. At least I'm sure he'll be at Las Vegas next year.
I'm sure, yeah. So we'll put a note in the show notes. We'll put a link to this, and it's actually great. It's his whole panel from Chicago Comic Con on the on YouTube. You can see the whole thing. So definitely worth checking out. We'll put that in the show notes. In June 1989, the Star Trek franchise took an interesting twist with the release of a film that many Star Trek fans like to pretend never existed, and that's Star Trek V, 1 hour and 46 minutes of goodness. No, it's Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, William Shatner's debut and final appearance as director of Star Trek on the big screen. Greg, we're going to talk about this movie today. And listeners, please do not turn off the podcast right here, because we really do want to talk about this movie because it is one of the original series films, and it has some good moments in it, and it has some bad moments in it. So, Greg, why don't you lead us in here to Star Trek V?
Star Trek V. I'm glad we're drinking right now.
Yes, we do have Japanese sake here in the studio tonight. We're recording the show at night.
Yeah. So it's a movie that has benefited by a good sense of humor and a lighthearted approach and possibly some alcohol if you are into that sort of thing.
This is a movie that drives fans to drink, right?
I know. I mean, It's not bad like some TOS episodes are just laughably bad. It's not...
So you're saying it's not Spock's brain?
It's not Spock's brain.
Although Spock's brain is actually quite an entertaining episode.
I think that's even what I'm saying. Like, it... You can't watch it and find, like, the subtext hilarious version of it.
Yeah, you can't laugh your way through
Star
Trek V.
It has its humorous moments that are intended, and you either find them funny or you don't really. And I think depending on my mood, I usually don't find them funny at all. So we talked about in the past, Star Trek IV. It's not my favorite Star Trek film, but it's many people's favorite Star Trek film, or at least high up there. And it has tons and tons of humor. So they decided, let's keep on with the humor thing. How do you think humor works in the 23rd century as opposed to the 20th?
Well, I think in the 23rd century, it's tougher to be funny because everyone's already heard all the jokes. So...
You don't mean my glommer shtick will be passé by the 23rd
that's
century?
That's right. Oh, glommer, man. That's old school stuff right there, Greg. I think you're right that Star Trek IV had a lot of humor that came naturally from the situation they were in, being in San Francisco in 1986. And I think that the writers and producers mistook that humor, the success of that humor, for thinking that the audience wants humor in Star Trek. I mean, Star Trek, of course, it has its funny moments. There are a lot of funny moments through the history of Star Trek in the different series, but at its core, Star Trek is not funny, and it's not intended to be funny. And one of the most noticeable things about Star Trek V is that they very clearly thought to themselves, Star Trek IV was funny, and the audience thought it was funny, and we need to continue that in Star Trek V. And the studio actually wanted to avoid making a very serious, dramatic film here, they say anyway, and keep it lighthearted. And the problem is that the storyline that they came up with for Star Trek V is not a lighthearted storyline.
Yeah, I feel like William Shatner came to this movie with an idea, a very dark idea. An idea of let's find God and sort of show him for what he truly is. Let's have Kirk's friends turn on him. Let's have him be alone, truly alone for the first time. But the producers didn't like that idea. So the script almost feels like it was watered down plot-wise. But then it feels almost like they had someone come in and add some humor. Just at... random places
like a politician would hire a joke writer a conference, right? I need a few jokes. A lot of it does feel like that. There are some moments where the humor seems natural and works, but there's a lot of forced stuff in there too. But talking about Shatner's darker idea for the script, because what we saw on screen is definitely watered down from what the original would be. Do you think that would have made a better movie? And do you think Star Trek fans would have accepted the idea of there being this problem between Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and Kirk, Spock, and McCoy turning their back on Kirk?
Yeah. Would it have worked? Is a hard question to answer. I mean, they've never done that sort of story. And the thing is, it wouldn't have been them truly turning their back. They were under the influence of Cybok.
Cybok stare.
Cybok's
under the influence
magic stare.
Of Cybok's magic stare.
But I feel like it could have worked really well. It might have become the Shatner movie is the only problem. One of the things I do like about this movie is that it does have that triumvirate. The Kirk, Spock, McCoy.
Yeah, that's one of the one good things about this movie.
I'm trying to remember the other ones. Khan was very Kirk focused.
Yeah.
3 was very Kirk, Spock. 4 experimented with like different groupings here and there.
Yeah.
So 5 is the first one. I guess Motion Picture. Motion Picture had so much in it. It's hard to even think of it as a traditional Star Trek storyline.
And even in Star Trek VI, Spock is separated from Kirk and Bones.
Right.
So it's like Kirk and Bones in Star Trek VI.
Right.
And then you've got Spock on the ship.
Precisely.
So this is one thing that I think doesn't get talked about a lot. Maybe people don't really realize or think about it, but Star Trek V is the one movie in the original series where we really have that triumvirate of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy together for most of the movie, which was kind of a cornerstone of the original Star Trek.
Right. And I think the early stuff in Yellowstone, actually, it really works. It's too long. It's edited kind of poorly. So there were production problems, obviously.
That's an understatement.
Right. They had like 2 months to shoot it. There was a writer's strike that went up right till production was about to begin. So he said, you know, they couldn't get the shots they needed. So the ways you could have finessed these scenes and made them shorter, you were limited in what you could do. So I understand, but as a film that we're watching now, 20 years later, it's hard to say, well, you know, they had production problems. You know, sure, but the film I'm watching is taking too long with some of these scenes. But I do like some of the humor there. You know, if they hadn't harped on the marshmallow thing so many times, it would have been funny.
Yeah. The thing about the marshmallows, though, is that it's so easy when you watch this movie to think that they're saying marshmallows.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like marshmallows. I mean,
I'm not sure which one you're saying now. So
that's what I mean. And you're sitting right across from me right now.
Exactly.
You can see my lips in full real life.
Right.
HD 3D. And you don't know what I'm saying. So, I'm not really going to buy that the writer's strike of 88 is to blame for Star Trek V. I can accept that the writer's strike affected the J.J. Abrams movie.
Right.
But not Star Trek V so much.
I can understand that.
There are a lot of other problems. But, first of all, we're making a Star Trek movie, and if we just jump into the movie here for a minute and we talk about this, it's just very, very odd opening that we have to this movie on Nimbus 3, the planet of galactic peace. Although we don't know what it is at the beginning of the movie, all we see is this desolate landscape with this really goofy guy.
Like, what neutral zone? Is it the Romulan neutral zone? And if so, why is there a planet in there that is being... What is this?
Well, we have the Klingon neutral zone. We have the Romulan neutral zone. Is there a Tribble neutral zone? between the Klingons and the Tribble homeworld?
That'd be a good idea.
So we really don't know which neutral zone we're in. We know that we're in this quadrant because that comes up later. But it's kind of an odd scene. And we have Cybok riding in on a horse, which, of course, we don't know it's Cybok. Yeah, we just see a silhouetted figure riding in on a horse. And then we have this really goofy guy who, again, we don't know why he's there either. And he's someone who I feel like would kind of believe anything that anybody told him. So the fact that Cybok's magic stare is able to influence this guy...
The opening... Okay, so my main problem with this film in general is it doesn't feel like a Star Trek film. And it starts with the opening, which the closest thing I can compare this opening to is like Firefly, where it's sort of this weird Western-feeling city, which, I mean, you don't even get the city in the opening, but you sort of get that sense. And then I guess you find out this guy's a Vulcan, but he's laughing. He's always laughing.
Yeah, he laughs and smiles way too much, and he's... Cybok is a pure Vulcan, right?
Right.
But it doesn't seem like a Vulcan at all.
Well, when Gene Roddenberry talks about this film, he says that certain parts are apocryphal. And I think the idea of Spock having a half-brother, you know, it doesn't really affect the film in any way. There's no reason that he is Spock's half-brother, except that Spock... feels some reason that he shouldn't shoot him at some point.
Yeah, and they have the scene where Spock is being born, and he tries to use that to in conjunction with the magic stair.
He did the same thing with Bones, where he knew somehow about what happened with his father. So I think he could have done that even if he was.
He didn't need to be a half brother.
He didn't even need to be a Vulcan. could have been. He could have been Elorian, like Dr. Sorin and Guinan. And it probably would have been better just to make him a new alien, because then you have all these questions of, if he's a Vulcan, okay, he's like an exile Vulcan, but why is he an exiled Vulcan? You know, why isn't he keeping with the Vulcan beliefs? And why does he have these magical powers?
Yeah, because we know that he kind of has rejected the Vulcan beliefs, but we don't know why, right? It's just, it's the kind of stuff that you can't necessarily cover in a movie, and so maybe it would be better not to get into it in the first place.
Well, what was the, we've got T'Pol staring me from your monitor here. What was the episode of Enterprise where they met up with some sort of exiled Vulcans who were going back to the old beliefs? They were sort of experimenting with emotions. I can't remember the name of the episode.
Yeah, I don't remember the name.
But it deals with this idea so much better than Star Trek V does, of what happens to a Vulcan when he sort of abandons the Vulcan ideals.
Yeah, because that was the premise of the episode.
Yeah.
Whereas here, it's just being used as a plot device to kind of set things in motion. And it's not even the point of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
This opening scene... besides the fact that it doesn't feel like Star Trek and we don't really quite know what's going on. And then the fact that William Shatner wanted to have unicorns instead of horses here as well, just adds to the kind of bafflement of this, of this whole sequence.
They said that sort of turned it into science, or like fantasy rather than science fiction.
Well, yeah. Cause they're unicorns.
Right? I mean, they even have horns. Like, I don't think Gene Roddenberry won fully in making them horses. They have something coming out of their head. It's not like a full unicorn horn going on, but they're blue and they have some sort of head ridge.
Like a blue stubicorn.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing that just distracts you from the film. This is a film that lacks, I don't want to say it lacks direction, because obviously William Shatner was there making decisions, but doesn't come across very well, where you understand, like, they say what a director has to do is have a vision, and then every time he makes a choice, it points towards that vision.
Yeah.
So what vision did Blue Horses point towards? What vision did having them not wear Starfleet uniforms for 90% of the film, why did they make that choice?
Yeah. I don't know. You asked me earlier, what is the point of Star Trek V, I guess? Because if you're going to make a movie, you ultimately have to know what message you're trying to convey in the movie, right? And the whole movie is designed to explore that concept, right? And for me, it's very simple what Star Trek V is about.
Okay.
Star Trek is, God is what we make him.
Right.
And that's the whole point of Star Trek V for me.
Okay.
The problem is that we never get there.
Yeah.
The movie doesn't explore that idea. It just tells you at the end of the movie, this was the idea we had for this movie. And by the way, sorry we forgot to explore it. There's the scene at the end of the movie, not to jump ahead too far, but there's the scene at the end of the movie. It's like the last thoughts.
Right.
It's like, when we do an episode of The Ready Room and we get to the end and we have like a conclusion, last thoughts, it's like they get to the end and Kirk's been rescued and Kirk and Spock and Bones are there and Kirk's kind of like, so Bones, any last thoughts on the movie? And it's kind of like that. And it's like at that point they deliver to you what the movie was supposed to be about.
Right.
But they didn't explore that during the movie. The whole movie is like hijacking the ship and flying to the center of the galaxy. And at the point that you get to the galactic barrier, that should have been at the beginning of the movie.
Right.
Because that's where the actual exploration of the concept of this movie begins.
Right.
And it begins at like the 1 hour and 30 minute mark of a 1 hour and 46 minute movie.
I mean, what if they actually, okay, so they start the movie at the galactic barrier, they pass through, they meet this god alien creature. And okay, now they do let him out. And then what does he do when he's out? And now Kirk has to stop him. There's an interesting movie. There's an interesting villain.
When we were watching that movie, and you said that the problem with this movie is that there is no threat. In the motion picture, which is a very plodding movie, but in the motion picture, V'ger is on its way to Earth, and they have to stop it, because if V'ger reaches Earth, it's going to destroy Earth. In the Wrath of Khan, Khan wants to destroy the Enterprise, and he's going to get his hands on the Genesis weapon, and maybe he can take the Genesis weapon and destroy, you know, Earth or another planet with that. It's a dangerous thing. And First Contact, the Borg are trying to prevent Earth from ever having First Contact in the first place and assimilate Earth. And in this movie, there's no threat.
Star Trek Insurrection, Troy wants to shave Riker.
That's right. And Riker says, okay, because if you shave me, we can take a bubble bath. But it's not exactly a threat. I mean, if Troy wants to shave you, it's not exactly a threat.
Okay.
I think I would say okay to that. But there is no threat in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, they tried to put it in with Claw.
Claw!
Claw!
I'm Captain Claw. I'm going to get Kirk.
And he never does. We watch the movie together, and he never actually does anything.
He doesn't do anything. They just cut to him every, like, 20 minutes to remind you that Claw is out there.
Yeah.
Trying to get Kirk.
And he's only there so Spock can, like, take over and shoot God in the face, which I don't know. Like, the Enterprise,
at the very end of the movie.
At the very, very end. Like, that could have been the Enterprise that did that.
Yeah.
there's no particular
Although
reason.
The Enterprise can't come down into orbit right above the mountain and hover in such a threatening way as the Bird of Prey does.
Okay.
Right? It wouldn't have looked the same if Kirk looked up and the Enterprise was right there.
It would have been better. It would have been better if it had.
Claw is like a... I think what happened is that the Twisted Sister concert that was in town, it ended, and they got Claw to come in after the concert because he was playing guitar during the concert. They asked him to just sit there. Can you just sit here and look through this periscope? And we're going to cut to you every 20 minutes, and you need to be angry at Kirk for some reason that we're not going to bother explaining. And you're not going to do much, but we're just, you know, we need to cling on to chase Kirk. Because that's just something we need to do.
I mean, is that
the
thing? Like, okay, Star Trek 1 had Klingons. Star Trek 2 was all about Klingons. Star Trek 3, Klingons 4.
Well, Star Trek 2 was about Khan, but we had Klingons.
Yeah, the Klingons were there. They were
appearing.
Yeah.
Some point.
They were threatening. They were dangerous. Star Trek 4, they were like on the Klingon ship. Star Trek 5, now we've got to have a Klingon. Star Trek 6, Klingons.
The Klingons want the Genesis device.
Why Klingons every movie? Why do we need an obligatory Klingon?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think, if I recall correctly, the Klingons appeared in, I think, 13 episodes of the original series.
That's right.
I may be off on that number, but something like that, out of 79.
Right.
Right? So it's not like the Klingons were there all the time in the original series, but when we get to the movies, it's just Klingon, Klingon, Klingon all the time.
Yeah.
And if the Klingons aren't there, the Klingon ships are there. Like in Star Trek 4, you have the Bird of Prey.
Right.
It's just always Klingon. So it's like we got to 5. It's like we have to have a Klingon. Even though the Klingons have nothing at all to do with the story of the concept here, let's just have this Klingon chase Kirk around. And
it could have been a Romulan ship. We talked about Romulans last week.
It could have been the Gorn from Arena.
It could have been the
he's
Gorn
just
captain.
He's mad at Kirk because he lost the fight.
You know? That would have been really good.
And he's just chasing Kirk around. It would cut to the Gorn every 20 minutes. Cut to the Gorn. So
I would have enjoyed
it. Could have
that.
Been anything. I mean, it was completely pointless having Claw.
So how many things have we don't Nimbus 3? We don't know where it is, and we don't know why it exists. Cybok, we don't know who he is, why he's Spock's brother, why he's a Vulcan. We don't know why there's a Klingon in the movie.
The Enterprise A. We don't know why nothing works on the Enterprise A.
It's broken. We don't know why Uhura and Scotty are like rubbing each other.
I know. Yeah. We don't know any of this stuff.
Yeah.
There's so much unexplained stuff that's kind of out of the blue in this movie. Yeah. And it's very distracting.
Yes.
a lot of Star Trek fans say, you know, you could never defend Star Trek V. And as much as we sometimes defend the unliked in Star Trek, like our defense of Enterprise, for example, it's really hard to defend this movie. And, you know, I don't want to just pound on Star Trek V here, but I mean, I really try hard to look for the good things in this, find what's good in this movie. And primarily two things I find that are good here. As we talked about earlier, we have Kirk, Spock, and McCoy together.
Yes.
A lot of the time. That's good. And the score by Jerry Goldsmith.
He's back. He does a great job.
Is fantastic. Yeah. You know, I swear the beginning of this movie, after the Nimbus, the three stuff, the Yosemite part of this movie, absolutely beautiful music by Jerry Goldsmith here. You could... If someone played this music for you, you could swear that Aaron Copland wrote this music during Yosemite. It's a fantastic score. That's one of the big pluses here.
Yeah. How about having a big movie, like a bunch of different planets? You have all of that in this. You have Earth, you have Nimbus, you have the Galactic Barrier and Shakari, and you have many places, many different places in space along the way. So it's a big film. You know, it doesn't feel as small as some of the films.
It's a big film until they land the shuttlecraft on the Enterprise, and that shuttle bay is think about the size of the studio here. I mean, it's like you can barely back in here. Back that shuttlecraft in. I mean, there's no way that that's the size of the shuttlecraft.
I hope not.
Docking bay on the Enterprise. No way.
Yeah, we talked about like they crashed the space the shuttle in, and it looks just like in Nemesis where they sort of crashed that little dune buggy into the Argo.
It is.
Which actually made sense in Nemesis.
Yeah.
But it's the same scene.
It is, and it's about the same amount of space.
Yes, right. There. It's
bizarre. Just you know, the many production problems in this movie. Just the scale problems.
I mean,
the shuttle bay scale problem makes absolutely no sense. It would mean that that part of the Enterprise is about as wide as two shuttlecraft,
right?
Which we know is not the case.
I mean, maybe they have a like in Japan, there are these parking lots that go up and down. And
yeah,
maybe they have one of those, and the shuttle bays get docked somewhere else.
You just pull a couple of shuttlecraft down, and then they. The valet.
The valet takes it.
They have a Starfleet officer who's like a valet. You hand him the keys to the shuttlecraft and he backs it in and then it goes up to like the sixth floor of the docking bay.
That'd be perfect.
Maybe.
Yeah. Well, you're right about the scale of it, that the shuttle bay feels way too small. We still spend way too much time on the bridge. I was looking at the corridors and they look just like on Next Gen, and I looked it up and They are the next gen
corridors.
They just went to Next Gen and put their actors in it, and so there are times when the film feels really small. There's the one room that I like, which I don't even know what it is, some conference room or something with the gigantic wheel.
Yeah.
Is a great room, and it's lit differently. It's not a room that like has a specific purpose.
Yeah, there's the big wheel, like from an old ship, and there are two white chairs in there,
right?
And some windows, and it looks like it's a place that you go to relax or just think. You know, you're just gonna. It's like a little observation, not an observation lounge, but just like a little observation room,
right?
With big windows, you can look out at the stars.
Yeah,
it's a nice room.
It's the sort of room that would be in a starship, but we never really see.
You never see. The we do spend a lot of time on the bridge in this movie, and we never see like engineering or sick bay.
Scotty's always anything. Up on the bridge doing stuff. Like,
well, it's because Uhura is up there, and
oh dear,
they got to go rub on each other in this movie for some reason, I don't understand.
Like so after she's been influenced by Cybok's magical stare, she's like rubbing him. But it's like they shot that scene and the first one of them together right after another because she's doing the same sort of Scotty Deer rubbing him on the face.
It's like she's herself at the beginning and she's under the magical stare later, but she's still just like rubbing Scotty. for. Which nothing in the history of Star Trek ever set that up, and it's just like some idea they had.
Yeah,
I maybe
I need to go back to Star Trek IV. Maybe they had some time alone together that I missed
in the cutscenes or something. All right, well, why don't we jump ahead a little bit, and when we okay, so much of this movie is spent with Cybok trying to get a starship. Okay. Now, apparently, Cybok can stare at people.
Yes.
And cause them to come under his spell. And one question we had was, if it's so easy for Skybok, if it's so easy, it's Luke Skywalker. If it's so easy for Cybok to bring people under his spell, why didn't he just go to a spaceport somewhere and stare at some people and get a starship way? Why does he need to take over an embassy on the planet of galactic peace and try to lure Starfleet and Klingon ships there?
Exactly. There's a point where William Shatner, okay, James Kirk, but he asked Cybok, wait, you staged all this just to steal a starship? And okay, that was my question too to the screenwriters and the guy who came up with the story, which is William Shatner. And Cybok doesn't even answer. He's just like, well, yeah, you know, that it made sense at the time.
It's all I could think of at the time. But
right. Yeah, now that you mention it,
I could have. You do it and you look back and you say, well, it seemed like a good idea at the time. But
right.
Now that you mention it, I guess I could have just gone and stared at some people at Space Dog. But, well, anyway, I've already done it now. So we're at the Galactic Barrier. What should we do?
Right.
And then Kirk says, well, we're already here.
We're already here. Let's do it.
Let's go down to the planet.
Right. I mean, honestly, okay, Cybok is Spock's half-brother.
Yeah.
He wants to explore. He has this great idea. How many episodes of Star Trek have we seen where someone comes to the Enterprise and has this great idea, and they just follow him wherever? There's like the Ultimate Computer. There's 11001001. There's Did I get it right that time? There's where no one has gone before. You know, someone just comes to the Enterprise and says, let's do this. And the captain says, whatever.
Whatever. Sure. Sounds like fun. Let's go do it.
So why didn't now I don't even know what his name is. Shylock?
Shylock, yeah.
Why didn't Cybok just come to Kirk and say, hi, I'm Spock's brother. I think we can go to the center of the universe in about 6 minutes and meet God. Doesn't that sound like fun?
Yeah. We don't have any orders, you know, for the next few days. Let's go do it. I think the point that we're making here, I mean, it sounds like we're just rambling about
I know.
Movie, but I think the point we're making here is that the whole movie until you get to the end is a setup for the premise, which should have been explained in a few minutes at the beginning instead of having the horse ride up.
Right.
And the movie should have been about the actual reason that Cybok wanted to go to the Galactic Barrier and an exploration of this kind of idea of spirituality and God that they were going for. And the threat, Greg, like you said earlier, if they allow God to leave this planet, what is the threat to Earth? What is the threat to the Federation and the galaxy?
Right.
That's what the movie should have been about. And that's kind of why we're kind of harping on all of this stuff that took place here, because all of this stuff was a setup for the premise of the movie, and it became the movie.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And it doesn't lead you anywhere. And and you don't really care what's happening because you're not invested in the fact that our heroes need to achieve something here or stop Cybok. Yeah. There's no reason for them to be doing all this other than maybe they don't want that Enterprise to be hijacked.
Right. Well, it's like, okay, so Cybok is bad because he stares at people and makes them follow him. Okay, so he's bad. But we don't know why exactly what he's doing is bad. So yeah, I could cut this film down to maybe, I don't know, half an hour of good stuff.
The most, yeah.
And that half hour might be a good start of a movie.
Yeah.
that you go from there. Okay, start them in Yosemite. I really have no idea what his name is anymore. Have Cybok steal the ship, get them to the Galactic Barrier, and start the film there. You don't need Claw. You don't need the half-brother thing. You don't even really need to get into the magic stair. You just... I mean, Khan took the ship, and he didn't need to do that to anyone.
Right. Yeah. It's just to the point that what you need is a good villain.
Right.
And a reason for him doing what he is doing. And all this other stuff is unnecessary.
Yeah. So yeah, to those of you out there who are writing a Star Trek film, you know, get to the point. Figure out what is your movie trying to say? And try to get there as fast as possible. Not to get off on too big of a tangent, but listening to somebody talk about how they're working on their new record. They're a rock musician. And the biggest feedback they're getting back from their producer is, get to your point. Get to your song's point and end the song. You don't need to have a 4-minute song or a 6-minute song. If you have a movie or a song that's 2 minutes long and it got to the point and it got it across and it did it well and you end it there, that's perfect.
Yeah.
There's no reason to drag it out. You know, if you're out of ideas, you know, get new ideas. Yeah. Don't just drag out your ideas.
And the thing about this movie is it's an hour and 46 minutes long. So it's not like it's Meet Joe Black.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't drag the movie itself out. They just dragged out the setup.
Yeah.
And forgot to make the movie.
Right.
Basically. So when people ask me about Star Trek V, I do sometimes say it's not as bad as you think it is. And rewatching it today, I think maybe it's as bad as you think it is. I guess when I say it's not as bad as you think it is, what I mean is that the concept behind the movie is not as bad as you think it is.
Okay, right.
I just realized in rewatching it again that the problem is that they kind of forgot to make the movie.
Right.
They made a movie. They forgot to make the movie that the concept was about.
Yeah, right. It's like, I don't know, it's like if you'd had Generations, but you didn't really know who Soren was. You didn't really have the conflict with Picard. And you didn't really get to the Nexus.
Right. You found out at the end of Generations that Soren wanted to get into the Nexus.
Right.
And you didn't really know much about the Nexus other than it had been mentioned by name a couple of times.
And then the Nexus comes and then goes away.
Right. Well, you see it. Like, as we get towards the end of Star Trek V, we get close. They were in this kind of observation room we're talking about,
right,
and they're traveling at warp 7. And you pointed out that the stars aren't moving outside the windows. And then, as it goes on, we start to see the Galactic Barrier outside the windows as they're talking. So it would be like we, at the very end of Generations, when Kirk and Picard have already come back, and if at that point we see the Nexus for the first time.
Right.
It would be like that. And then we find out at that point that Soren really wants to get into the Nexus.
Yeah.
It's almost like that. It's like everything else that happened was for nothing.
Yeah. Well, it's like James Cameron is so good at making a whole film and then giving you another 30 minutes that you didn't even realize was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what this movie needed to some extent, where you get to this planet, and okay, you had to get there efficiently, and it had to make sense when you got there. And then you meet this god, and you think, okay, meeting him is going to be the end, but then there's more.
Yeah, see, that would have been it.
Right.
The whole hijacking happens very early on.
Yeah.
Like the first 20 minutes of the movie is the hijacking.
Right.
Around the half-hour mark, they get to the Galactic Barrier.
Yeah.
They meet God, and the final hour of the movie is about stopping this alien. I mean, we're calling him God, but he's an alien who's kind of making Cybok think he's God, right? This alien trying to escape from the planet, and they have to stop him because there's some great threat. That's the final two-thirds of the movie.
Right, so that's your movie.
That's your movie.
Right.
And that's not what we got. So
it's not. So Star Trek V... Is it worth even seeing? Should people watch 1, 2, 3, 4, 6?
No. Well, I'm going to say that I think that any real Star Trek fan should, of course, watch this movie because you have Star Trek fans who love a particular series and don't really care about the others. And that's fine. I mean, that's, you know, for some people, that's great.
Yeah.
If you really consider yourself a Trekkie who loves all of Star Trek, you shouldn't skip this movie and you shouldn't dismiss it as like not existing. You should watch it. And I watch it from time to time, even though it's one of the very weakest parts of all of Star Trek. But it is a part of Star Trek, and there are things in there that that you should know as part of Star Trek. There's some good stuff in there between Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. In fact, there are some moments in there that are the best relationship moments between those three in all of the original series and the TOS movies.
Yeah.
So you should watch it, but you know you don't need to put it on your frequent playlist in iTunes or anything like that.
Well, maybe you should also have Star Trek VI and just watch it immediately there, immediately after.
As a cleanser.
Right. And pretend like, okay, you have no idea how that movie ended, but now here's a new movie, here's a new plot, it's fine.
Yeah.
Just remember the good parts.
So you can do that.
And try to pretend, okay, as a movie it fails, as a series of a few great scenes, it's great, and I definitely agree with you. You should watch those scenes and sure, watch it in context. Yeah, be aware that the movie didn't quite get made.
Yeah.
Somehow. Yeah. I don't know who to blame. Writer's strike, William Shatner.
Blue Horses.
Harve Bennett. I mean...
I think you should blame the Blue Horses.
We'll blame the Blue Horses, sure. That's as good as anything else.
Yeah. I would also recommend, if you like the music of Star Trek and you don't have the soundtrack, regardless of how you feel about the movie,
right?
I do recommend that fans pick up the soundtrack to Star Trek V.
Because definitely.
It's a really excellent soundtrack. Yeah.
All right, Chris. Well, I was a little worried about talking about Star Trek V and if there was actually anything left to be said. There's some great resources out there. There's a Riff Tracks commentary track that just lashes into the film pretty harshly. You should definitely check that out if you haven't. But I think, you know, there's some good parts, and I think we're able to have an interesting discussion about this one. I'm definitely looking forward to getting back to some more of the high-quality parts of Star Trek next week.
Yeah, it was fun to talk about it. It's one I was a little bit worried to talk about, too, because it's easy to come across as bashing Star Trek in this, and of course, that's not our intention. And one reason we maybe come down hard on this film is because we love Star Trek so much.
Yeah.
And but like you said, there are some good moments in this movie. You know, I'm not going to come out and try to convince people that this is a great movie that they need to see. But it has its moments, and you should check it out.
Definitely.
So I'm pretty sure our listeners have some thoughts about Star Trek V.
Oh, yeah.
Probably a few choice words for this movie as well. If you do have something you want to share with us about Star Trek V, you can send us a message by going to trek.fm/contact. And if you want to leave us a voicemail, you can do that as well. Just call 646-652-TREK. And you can catch us on Twitter as well, where we're always talking about Star Trek. Just follow username TrekFM on Twitter. And Greg, you're on Twitter as well.
Yeah, so I'll now be tweeting on Trek FM on U.S. time.
Oh, that's
so
true. Good point.
Look forward to that. And same thing with my personal account, Greg Harbin. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N. So starting tomorrow as we're recording, but by the time this is out, I should be on Pacific time. So look forward to me being maybe a little bit more interactive with some of you people who are not quite as night owls as who I've been talking to as of now.
Yeah, that's a good point, because, you know, right now with the Trek of Film account, Greg and I have both been in Japan, and so we're tweeting, maybe interacting with followers during what is daytime and evening here. So we do have a kind of a period of daytime in the U.S. where we're not able to really interact with people.
Oh, yeah.
And that's going to change now. So
yes.
That's wonderful.
Looking forward to it.
And I also have my personal account on Twitter if you want to hook up with me there too. That's C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And one more thing we want to remind you to do is to test your Trek IQ by playing Trek Trivia. We've been getting some good feedback from our new format, which has images and it's interactive. And you know, if you missed the question, you can go back, you can try again. People seem to like that a lot. Just go over to trek.fm/trektrivia to play Trek Trivia, and you can follow username Trek Trivia on Twitter. Mark Stamper and Anthony Davis run quizzes several times a week on there, live interactive. And great way to connect with Star Trek. So, Greg, I think I'm going to head out before Cybok tries to come and try his magic stare out on me.
Yeah, Chris. Yeah, I think it's time to stick a blue horse in it. 'Cause the Ready Room is done.